I know that you have done, you've published a paper, I think it was maybe even earlier this year, kind of giving an overview of some of the marine potential generally of resources in this country. And I know you ranked Cook Inlet number one.
That's right.
Why?
So Alaska has 90% of the nation's tidal energy potential. It's probably not surprising to many Alaskans that's the case, but, you know, we've got a massive coastline, and we also have large tides here. So we have large tides, we have a lot of small inlets and bays, and so we get a lot of those pinch points. And so that's why we have so much energy in Alaska in general. Now, Cook Inlet in particular is a third of the nation's energy potential, tidal energy potential.
Of all the tidal energy in the country, Cook Inlet has one third of the potential.
Exactly, exactly. That's, and
wow,
yeah, it's really exciting as someone who grew up here. You know, when I was talking about tidal energy with my dad, as a kid, I didn't know this, and it was not a linear path from, you know, those days of dreaming about tidal energy to now leading the tidal energy resource assessment work for the Department of Energy. I did not intend for that to be my end goal, and now that I'm here, it's really exciting. And I remember the first time I was looking at some of the early reports on tidal energy, and I was like realizing that Cook Inlet is this massive opportunity. And yeah, the prospects of being able to go home and do some of this work was really exciting. The other thing that makes tidal energy in Cook Inlet particularly interesting is, you know, like I said, Alaska's got a lot of potential tidal energy sites, but many of those sites are a long ways away from population centers. And so, you know, there aren't these locations where you have ready, you know, need for the power. But Cook Inlet is unique in that it is located right along the rail belt. There's a high voltage transmission substation just a few miles away from the site that we're going to be looking at this summer. And I mean, the other thing that from the standpoint of people who are in, you know, the energy sector, that makes Cook Inlet interesting is that the energy prices in Alaska are pretty high. So, you know, while that's bad for the public, you know, energy user, for someone who's developing a new technology, those high energy prices mean potentially a higher profit or higher returns. And so all those factors, the fact that it's a massive resource, it's located right along, you know, right adjacent to the most of the population of the state, and the energy prices are high, make it a really exciting opportunity.
I know a local utility has already pledged, I guess, to buy energy from one of the companies that's exploring placing a generator down there. So it seems kind of like there's already interest from a utility, which I know is one of the biggest hurdles, right, is making sure you have someone to buy this power if you're going to invest in this huge project. I mean, how can you kind of, you know, how exciting or how novel is it that there is this interest from a utility? Is that something that you think we're going to be seeing a lot more of, is kind of these pre-production agreements from local utilities on the rail belt?
I mean, I'm not going to speak to, you know, the probability of pre-production agreements. But I will say that, you know, I think Homer Electric Association is doing some, you know, some pretty exciting things in the space of renewable energy. It was really exciting to see that they signed onto that agreement with,
ORPC,
Ocean Renewable Power Company. Yes. ORPC. I've spoken some with HEA already, and I'm actually working on a project with them where we want to figure out sort of how tidal energy could fit into the electricity mix that's available in this area. One of the things that the Water Power Technologies Office at DOE is particularly interested in, because they look at both hydropower and marine energy, including tidal energy, is how, you know, some of the hydropower resources that we have on the grid, and in especially the Bradley Lake hydro project, how that could integrate with tidal energy. Could you sort of, when the tides are flowing, you could sort of hold water back at Bradley, and then when the tides are low, you could run Bradley a little bit faster, and therefore sort of get like a base load out of the combined project. Those sorts of things are things we're going to be looking at in this project. And I think, yeah, it's really exciting to see the interest from the utilities here for sure.
That's fascinating, kind of figuring out how this fits in with other, because tidal energy is very predictable, right? So it has base load potential. I also know that HE has talked about figuring out how to store tidal power on its batteries. I mean, what are some of the, you know, most important logistics about getting tidal power onto the grid? Or are there any considerations that are unique to tidal power when it comes to kind of putting it onto a utilities grid that you know of?
So this isn't my area of expertise, but, you know, we often say that tidal energy is probably the most predictable renewable energy resource, right? You know, you can buy a tide table that'll tell you what the tides are going to be doing for the next year.
Right, you know, we all have that app on our phone.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you can also probably extrapolate that out to like 30 years. And so once we start to get some experience with these devices in the water, I think it won't be very long, you know, a matter of months or maybe a year before you're able to say, we can rely on this thing to give us this much power, you know, at exactly these times, and really predict that out. There are scenarios where if you place tidal farms at different points along the inlet, you could potentially get baseload out of those different out of the combination of those two resources. I'm not sure sort of how feasible that's really going to be, because the Forelands are such an energetic site. I think that's really where you're going to want to be. And they're, you know, that's essentially one site in terms of the phase of the tides.
How big is this area we're talking about, the Forelands?
Yeah, so there's actually two channels between the East and West Forelands. The East channel is about a kilometer, or it's about a kilometer and a half wide, and it's about 60 meters deep. That's another thing, actually, that makes the site so promising, in my opinion, is the depth is really perfect for especially early stage technologies that we're looking at. You know, you don't want a site that's super shallow, like say 30 feet deep, because you're not going to be able to put in very large turbines. On the other hand, you don't want a super deep site, because then the logistics of anchors and power and your power cables back to shore and figuring all that out is a lot more complicated. So having these this site where the water depth is about 200 feet is kind of a really nice sweet spot in terms of being able to test some early technologies. The channel on the western side is much deeper. I think it's over a couple hundred feet deep, but you see much larger currents over there. So in the long term, that may be where the large, you know, if you wanted to do really large scale energy extraction from Cook Inlet, that would probably be where you would end up. And, you know, just to put the size of this project in context, there's the current estimate is 18 gigawatts of theoretical potential from Cook Inlet. And that's roughly 20 times the power that the rail belt, so all from Fairbanks down to Homer, uses. And so you could build a tidal array that kind of spans a relatively small portion of Cook Inlet and delivers a substantial fraction of the rail belt's power needs.
That number that you just threw out, where did we get that? How did we measure kind of that capacity?
That 18 gigawatt number. Yeah, so that comes from, there's a paper, Garrett and Cummins, that sort of laid the foundation of how you quantify tidal resource potential. And you basically take the amplitude of the tides and you multiply it by the volume flux of water. So how much water flows back and forth through the Forelands each day. And I don't have that number off the top of my head, but it's big, and there's a lot of energy there. Yeah.
It sounds like when we're talking about the conditions of the water and the technology, there's kind of a lot of Goldilocks scenarios, right? Like, you don't want the water to be too deep, but you don't want it to be too shallow. You kind of have these perfect, points that we want to reach. And I imagine a lot of these companies are developing different sorts of technologies where, even if they're kind of similar in theory, I know, for example, ORPC, their technology is patented, so they have their own kind of generator system. Do you think we're going to see a lot of different kinds of generators, and people are going to be figuring out what is the best way to go about this? Is there going to be a lot of collaboration? Kind of on the technical side, what sort of landscape are we looking at? I know you said it's really, really early for this sort of technology still.
Yeah, it is very early for this technology, and because of that, there still are big questions about what the technologies are going to look like. ORPC uses what we call a cross-flow turbine. You see a lot of wind turbines on people's houses or on buildings that are these vertical axis sort of spiral shaped turbines. And ORPC has turned that on its side, essentially. And that's what their technology is. And then a lot of the other tidal technology companies, Verdant Power, Orbital Hydro is another European company. They use something that looks more similar to a wind turbine in terms of having two or three blades that face into the flow, and the flow is along the axis around which that turbine turns. So we call those axial flow devices. But there's still a lot of questions. I think those two kind of basic concepts is probably what these things are going to end up looking like. But there's a lot of questions about whether they're going to be bottom fixed. Are they going to be floating? Are they going to be flying in the middle of the water column, or will they be floating at the surface? Those types of questions are still to be figured out. And how do you get the power then back to shore as well is another, you've obviously got to have a power cable, but does that power cable go underground or through the water? There's a lot to figure out still.
Sure. And of course, when we're talking about the Forelands, we're talking about Nikiski, which is like the seat of oil and gas in this area. That area has suffered from kind of the way the industry has been changing. And I know a lot of people have lost their jobs here. Can you talk a little bit about the potential economic impacts of having a tidal project in Nikiski on the peninsula?
Yeah, so in the short term, we're talking about a lot of R&D to test a lot of different technologies in this area is going to be important to seeing, helping drive the technology forward and building the industry to where it needs to go. So that's really where it's going to be for the next decade. And then once you start to actually build, if a larger scale project starts to be built, that's when you start to see a lot of, blue collar jobs. There's going to be a lot of marine operations work. There's going to be, a lot of, if they are manufacturing the turbines here, or I'm sure at least the, some of the structures that support the turbines, it would make sense to manufacture those here. So there's going to be a lot of work in that space. But looking out even farther than that, in the renewable energy industry for, you know, the last, since really since it started, right, there's been this question about energy storage. And how do you, you know, with variable renewables, being able to store energy efficiently and cost effectively has been one of the main challenges of renewable energy. But I feel like we're starting to see the page turn on that. And if you start to think about, you know, the fact that we have more energy in Cook Inlet than we need, and Alaska has massive, you know, onshore wind and offshore wind energy potential. We've got massive wave energy potential along the Aleutian Chain. Then if energy storage technologies, such as we often call them e-fuels, or, you know, sometimes people just talk about hydrogen, if the cost of renewable fuel production comes down sufficiently, then you start to talk about having an export of renewable energy economy potential. And to me, that's what the real opportunity is. And the exciting thing about talking about renewable energy in Alaska is that, you know, Alaskans know we have massive resources here. And what I'm trying to say is we also have massive renewable energy resources. And so let's start thinking ahead about how we can use those when energy storage technologies come online. And I think, you know, Governor Dunleavy recently signed the Alaska Energy Independence Act. And, you know, I'll just use a quote here. He says, "This bill and this concept is something all Alaskans can get behind because the focus is cheap, reliable energy opportunities that can benefit all Alaskans on both a micro and macro level. With the state's abundance of renewable fuel sources like water, wind, and solar, Alaska is poised to be a leader in energy independence for its citizens." So, you know, I think that's an example of an administration that recognizes the renewable opportunity and is starting to think about how to invest in that. And I think that's exciting.
Yeah, politically, kind of, we're at this, such an interesting moment where it seems, and I'm sure you've been following this much more closely than I have, but it seems kind of like lawmakers who in the past have been a little bit less excited about the potential of renewable energy are kind of embracing, at least here, tidal energy and some other forms, and geothermal and solar. I mean, how has kind of the embrace of tidal and of renewables changed since you started at NREL 10 years ago? Has there been a lot of change in the public opinion or kind of in the political sector in terms of how this resource was seen and embraced?
I mean, I agree that it feels like we're at this transition moment. You know, I've been at NREL, so everyone there is just always excited about renewables all the time, right? And so, you know, it feels like I've maybe been in a little bit of a bubble, but at the same time, you know, Senator Murkowski has been a huge advocate for marine energy technologies, and I think she's an all of the above energy solutions, you know, policymaker, lawmaker, and I really commend her for that. I think she's done. From the marine energy team's perspective, she's been really supportive of the work that we do, and I think it's because she recognizes both that, you know, Alaskans are feeling the effects of climate change, right? In Alaska, we're sort of at the forefront of realizing that climate change is impacting people's lives in a real way here. And I think she also realizes that Alaska has these massive marine energy opportunities and offshore wind opportunities. And so, you know, I see her and other lawmakers on both sides of the aisle being supportive. And I think that support is just going to get stronger as time goes on, because I do think that renewable technologies are the future.
We've talked a little bit about cost, and I'd love to talk about some of the hurdles or just some of the factors that we're still trying to figure out when it comes to tidal energy. So my understanding is you have to make sure there's a market, which we're getting closer toward now that, you know, HEA has signed an agreement with a company. That seems kind of like we're solving the problem of whether or not you have a market in some respects. You have your cost because the technology is still so expensive, especially, you know, versus wind and solar, other renewables. And then I imagine there's also some environmental and regulatory considerations, right? Like, how do you put in these generators and not mess up conditions for salmon or for the beluga, the Kokanlit belugas, which, what are you thinking about when it comes to these hurdles? And is there anything else that you think, will need to be kind of figured out before this technology can really take off?
So the environmental effects are something that we at NREL are thinking about a lot. And in particular, at Pacific Northwest National Lab, actually, which is one of our sister national research labs, is really leading a lot of the research on environmental effects. And in this space, they look at things like collision risks. So this would be, you know, actually a turbine or a device or some piece of a device hitting either a fish or a marine mammal. They also look at the noise that comes off of these devices, and, you know, does that create problems for the fish and the mammals? Electromagnetic fields from the cables is something we look at. The changes in the habitat due to the devices. So in some cases, they're starting to see that, for example, for offshore wind, they're actually corals are establishing on the foundations of the turbines. So that's sort of an example of how, renewable technology may actually be helping the ecosystem. And then there's also going to be, you know, we're looking at things like moorings and cable interactions with fish and with marine mammals. So the point is that we're looking at all this. We're paying really close attention. It's super important, I think, that we get this data in these early projects, and it's going to continue to be a major focus of our research, is understanding what these risks are and if there are challenges, you know, looking for ways to mitigate them. And I think, you know, in the wind industry, one of the things that frequently gets pointed out as sort of a negative, I guess, of wind is, you know, birds and bird deaths. And for some reason, what gets left out of that conversation a lot is kind of the scale of the bird deaths. So, you know, I was looking yesterday, the latest numbers that we have suggest that cats, both house cats and feral cats, kill 10,000 times more birds than wind turbines. And windows kill something like 1,000 times more birds than wind turbines do. But, you know, that's kind of like anecdotal. I think what's more a more important indicator is the Audubon Society is a big supporter of wind. And that's because they know that climate change is a huge risk to birds, and so wind turbines are a much lower risk to birds basically than climate change. So they're looking at all the data, they're working with wind project developers, and they're helping them sort of site their projects in locations mm-hmm. where it's going to be a reduced risk to birds. And I think the corollary in the ocean is that Carbon-driven ocean acidification is a huge threat to fish and marine mammals and ocean ecosystems in general. And so by reducing the amount of carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere, I think by using marine energy instead of fossil fuels, I think is actually potentially a lower risk to fish and marine mammals. But that's, you know, like I said, this is stuff that we're continuing to research.
Well, and I don't want to speak for anyone, but I've talked to some folks from environmental groups, and they have said something very similar, is that their worries about the impacts of continuing to use fossil fuels outweigh their worries about the impacts of these technologies to local ecosystem. So I think that there are some definitely parallels to that wind scenario that you're mentioning. And that's really interesting about the cats.
Yeah. There's not a lot of talk about getting rid of cats and windows, even though they're a much bigger threat to birds than...
And if you're coming, you know, on public radio to talk about getting rid of cats, you're barking up the wrong tree. Yeah. So one of the last things I kind of want to ask you about is the timeline, because we've talked a lot about all of this. And in some levels, it's kind of conceptual, but we are starting to see some movement. How would you kind of lay out for someone what the timeline for tidal energy projects looks like, and how does your study this summer fit into things or move things along?
So, you know, as I keep saying, tidal technologies are at a very early stage and the costs are just too high. So there, we've got to do a lot of research in terms of improving the reliability of these technologies, as well as driving the costs down. And so in the short term, you know, like I said, there's going to be more research on understanding the site before anything can happen there. And then, you know, whether a project happens at this site is not a, you know, I have like zero power in making that decision, right? It's going to be up to, you know, the public and, you know, the companies and the utilities. But if something does move forward, you know, I think it'll be, you know, a few years before we're seeing the first devices go in the water. And then it'll be several years of, you know, monitoring those devices and improving them. And, you know, I think it would be really exciting if we did see those first few devices go in the next few years, just because Alaska could then be in the middle of, you know, developing these technologies and proving that they can work and developing technologies that are robust enough for Cook Inlet, which is one of the most energetic tidal sites and most challenging sites in the country, right? Like, we've got ice, we've got sediment, we've got...
It's an extremely dynamic area. I mean, do you think if there's any chance any other tidal energy, ocean tidal energy projects are developed in Alaska before this project because of just kind of the magnitude of the tides in Cook Inlet? Or do you think that the Forelands is kind of on track to be the first of its kind in the state?
That is also above my pay grade. But from my perspective, I think this is where, you know, personally, I think this is where we should be looking at tidal energy, because it's right here where we've got the industrial infrastructure to support projects. The resource is here in terms of, you know, the tidal energy is here. The grid is here. This is where the power could be used. So there are some other small communities. You know, Igiagig is a community that has really been at the forefront of testing, you know, river technologies, and there's a lot to be learned from that. But as far as tidal, I do think Cook Inlet is one of the most promising sites in Alaska.
You mentioned the data you collect will be public in 6 or so months after. Where else is the data that you collect going to go, and where can people find it?
So we have, like I said earlier, the Marine Energy Atlas will be available through there. It'll be mostly like a large data set that would be downloaded primarily for researchers, but there will be versions that could be useful to the public. The data is going to be used a lot to validate models of the site, because, you know, we're only able to make measurements at a relatively few locations. We have a really high resolution bathymetry data set. So that's a map of the surface of the bottom of the ocean. And so with that high res bathymetry data set and these measurements, I think we'll be able to run some numerical models that give us a really detailed picture of the resource sort of all within the area of the East Foreland. And then once you have that, that's when you can really get into picking out exact locations where you would want to site turbines in the area, and how you would, you know, how you would design an array, or how you would space the devices and those sorts of things. But that is, like I said, that's still probably 5 to probably at least 10 years out before we're designing arrays.
And we're going to leave it here for now. A huge thank you to Levi Kilcher for joining us on the show today. You can listen to this whole conversation again at kdll.org. This was Kenai Conversation. I'm Sabine Pooks.